Paolo Salieri, Italian-born architect, visionary, and recently theologian, sees humanity in terms of evolution, a 3-billion-year-long struggle which has resulted in consciousness. Man is not the end result of life. He is only a stage in the adventure, and he now must consciously take up the burden of making the future. Miniaturization, complexification, the process whereby each higher level of evolution rises above the preceding stage, and a process that was described by Teilhard de Chardin, is applied by Salieri to the urban environment. He arrives at the arcology, the high, three-dimensional, one-structure city that will permit man to reach higher levels of consciousness by improving the connections and accessibility of people and other elements within the city to each other. He provides a framework within which man can bridge the chasm between matter and spirit. This program is about Arcosanti, a proto-arcology Salieri is building in the desert of Arizona. The material presented in this program, including the piano, was recorded at Arcosanti. In the background, you will hear the sounds of construction going on.
There is to define an urban environment, and since we don't have it, we are deprived. So it's a deprived society. But since also I'm convinced that the urban environment that man needs is not available in too many places, I feel it is necessary to try to define it somewhere and accept this condition of deprivation.
Paolo Salieri is talking to a group of new workshoppers.
If you went there 5 years ago, there was nothing, cattle and coyotes and plants. Now we have an average of, let's say, 70 people throughout the year, a mix of the permanent and transient.
The transient are people, mostly young, many of them architecture students, but not necessarily so, who participate in a 6-week workshop and pay about $350 towards the cost of building materials, construction equipment, and food. Salieri is able to match part of the contribution made by workshoppers from funds earned from the sale of his bells, books, and the fees from lectures.
But the problem is this constant turnover of people, and this is, for the moment, it's unavoidable. Because in order to keep going with the work, we need that input of cash and effort that you are bringing. So since every one of you is limited in this possibility, in this ability, you get to take you in for 6 weeks and then say, I'll see you later.
There's something about the fact that we're volunteering to do this work and we're not getting paid, so that I think it's a closer community than it would be if everybody's getting paid here. I think there's a special attitude about the construction and just the work that goes into the place.
The permanent are the staff, all of whom originally participated in a workshop and decided to stay on. They are paid subsistence wages, which start at $20 per week, $15 of which goes to food. At present, the community is centered in what is known as the camp, where minimum shelter is provided in buildings called cubes. The cubes were built as an experiment to test the size of various spaces. 8-foot cubes were found to be impractical. The space is too small, sufficient merely for sleeping and for storing luggage. 12-foot cubes were found to be more satisfactory. The added height gives more space to move in, and it gives one's brain a chance to breathe, so to speak. Also in the camp are bathrooms with showers and a communal space called the Octagon. Tony Brown, site architect, talks about life in the camp.
Last year was absolutely diabolical. Middle of the summer, nobody brought any. There was nobody living across the river. There's no trucks. There's nowhere to park. And so we had about 140 people at one time living in the camp. And It also was the year that Leachfield decided to quit on us. So we were really in terrible shape. So at the end of the year, we were frantically trying to think of ways of getting new accommodation. So what we did is on the new applications one you got, I guess this is the bigger one, which had a lot more information on it. It also said bring tents and sleeping bags and sleep in your trucks. So the problem actually disappeared this year. Most people in the summer brought tents and slept out in their tents, and the truck parking there sold a lot. It just evaporated just by rewording the application, which is kind of neat.
Also in the camp is a kitchen where cooks provide a choice of meat or vegetarian meals. Surrounding the buildings are gardens, supplying such produce as corn, beans, squash, and tomatoes, and also some flowers. All water is obtained from a well that was originally for the cattle that roam on the ranch. I try to talk with Mary, the person responsible for keeping the camp and construction site supplied with all needed materials.
I am the gopher.
And what do you do?
I go back and forth to Phoenix getting building materials and food.
Do you find this an interesting occupation?
Oh, it's fascinating, especially for a born gossip, because you get to know everything that's going on, more or less. And I move very quickly.
Yes, I'm trying to keep up with you.
You have to keep fast or keep going fast. You never get to all the places you have to go every day.
Frugality, an integral part of Soleri's philosophy, is given practical expression at Arcosanti in the recycling of all recyclable materials from kitchen and the construction site. Soleri talks about the construction process, which started in 1969.
The process is very slow because of problems with means and so on. One advantage of being so slow is that everybody gets used to it. People are more used to Arcosanti now than they were used five years ago, because when we moved there 5 years ago, what they saw only were long hair, beards, and promiscuity. Now I think nobody bothers about that. After we were there for a while, there was a certain mountain, you know, front against us. But then that collapsed because we were not that as bad as they thought we were. And one reason was because they saw we were working very hard at it, whatever it was.
It, of course, is Arcosanti, which is being built on top of a mesa.
You have to keep in mind the peculiar character of Arcosanti as a prototype, as the motorcycle built in a garage. It doesn't have to fit a frame of reference, which is the normal. You want to affirm something, so you get to the point where you have to affirm it, no matter how and where and what.
I asked whether the building process will speed up in the future.
I think it will have to, just because more people are here and telling other people, and it's sort of a nuclear fission type of thing. If it's done at all, it'll probably be completed within 20 or 25 years, I think.
I'm thinking now that one of the best ways of getting this moving fast would be for us to be involved in another. We have to come up with serial things in order to really have a backbone. So if we could get involved with the same methodology in something that, instead of being for 2,000 people and being in a way queer for many people, would be more acceptable, I think that new project would be very good for this project.
A central part of the design of Arcosanti is the apses, or half domes, that will be 200 feet high. These apses will have double skins, or walls, and there will be living space sandwiched in between the two walls. All living units at different heights of the apse will have a unique space, for the angle of the walls changes with height, the walls being almost upright close to the ground and being horizontal at the top of the apse. Next, some workshoppers talk about the buildings that have been completed so far.
The forms here are really terrific. Lots of neat concrete and textures and plants and growing things and neat people. There's a couple of rather small apses, which are quarter spheres, which are done in concrete, which are facing south to catch the sun for the most useful part of the year, catching the heat in the winter and giving shade in the summer, so they're sort of naturally climate controlled.
The water that is collected from the rain runoff runs out to very long spouts and run down into the leaching field to eventually water olive trees. It's a very nice ecological touch.
Paolo explains the design of the apse.
There is something similar at Cosanti, and that was built by me personally and was organized by me personally, and I think it works fairly well. And I was working there for many years, and I felt that doing ceramics in that environment was more than just work, was pleasant. So I felt that if someone else connected with me was going to do ceramics, it should have the same kind of pleasantry, the same kind of environment. So instead of coming up with what you might call a very efficient, rational ceramic work area, I came up with a translation of that into this. I wanted to build a place where that experience could be repeated with additional advantages.
And there's also a large vault space, which is right now used as a construction area, and some living quarters off of those. And in construction right now is a 3 or 4 story restaurant. The techniques are more or less something that Paolo has derived. You don't see it anywhere else in commercial construction in terms of silt casting and the way he's using concrete in its most plastic form. Silt casting is a technique that Paolo developed mostly as a crafts method when he started working with bells, digging out hollow forms in the earth and putting clay into it and extracting bells from this. And then he got to sort of using it in a reverse sense by building up dirt mounds and then putting concrete over this and then scooping out the dirt from underneath. This is the technique that he used down in Cassanti and Scottsdale. The apses here are more technologically developed from that. They're a little more complicated and a little less earthy. They're not directly built with mounds of earth, but scaffolding is put up and dirt is put over forms there. And then ridges are carved into that, and then concrete put on the surface of that, and then the earth is removed. There are also lots of textures and colors which are applied to the surface of the dirt, which is then left on the surface of the concrete after the earth has been removed. So there are all sorts of really nice colors and forms and textures on the buildings and in the buildings and a part of the buildings here.
I asked several participants why they came to help build Arco Santi.
I was kind of hanging a little bit loose, actually. It's, I was taught for 2 years and didn't like that, and was sort of in a transition. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. I kind of wanted to get out to this area, and I heard Paolo speak, and it sounded interesting enough so that, you know, at worst, it'd be a pleasant 6 weeks. And I guess one of the other contributing reasons is that there's also a pretty good group of people here. There's a chance to do reading and a chance to, for me, it's a lot of intellectual stimulation and kind of all of things combined is a sort of tough thing to be. You don't get a chance to be in that sort of situation very often.
I heard about it from a friend of mine, and I've been pretty down on architecture and so-called progress of mankind, and I was looking for something better than what I've seen, so I thought I'd try Arco Santi.
Just the idea of archaeology brought me here in the first place. But I come back because that's a special place. I know people here, and I just like it here.
I studied architecture for a while, and I was working in a couple of offices and was bummed out by that. And I heard about Paolo in school, and so I thought I'd come here and see what was really going on. When I was in school, some friends of mine came out here, and they built the cubes.
I came from Detroit, and after living in Detroit, I went to college in a very in sort of an urban environment. And at that time, I left for about a year and lived very far out in the secluded countryside. And at that time, I realized the cultural benefits, the social benefits, all the things that I missed from the city.
Sue Blocher.
But yet I was unwilling to subject myself to the cities as they were. And I read Paolo's book, The City in the Image of Man, and thought that he was offering a possible solution to a person who wanted to have the benefits of the natural landscape and have the cultural and social benefits of the urban environment. I came out in a workshop, and I mixed concrete, and I tied steel, and dug ditches, and in about 3 months became the camp director, which was a job that was basically concerned with maintenance work and keeping the community in proper order.
In your role as camp director, what did you learn about people's reasons for coming?
I think most people come with a very limited knowledge about what's here, but they've come because they've either read Paolo's books or they've heard that a man named Soleri has some type of viable alternative, and I think one of the unique things about it is that they feel it's very comprehensive. And when they come, they find that we have something very far from an arcology here.
Circumstances are such that you can't avoid at least part of this expectation of a paradise or a utopia, and finding out that instead of it's sweat and tragedy.
But I think they all go away with feeling that it's a very unique experience, in that they live and work and eat and play and discuss and learn with the same people for the duration of their stay here. And it is, in a way, isolating people in sort of a brainstorming session about the problems that we're trying to deal with here.
A workshopper comments on the community.
The community is too homogenous. Everyone comes from the same general background, although people vary widely in their interests and so forth. Basically, we're all of the same age group, from the same economic background. And I think it will really be important to get a better mix of people in the working community. Families are starting to come in next year. There's a program starting for them. I think it'd really be helpful to tap some older citizenry and get some skilled, retired, middle-aged people here, so that will add a much greater complexity to the community here as it grows.
There have been older people at Arcosanti. Nancy Gushman claims to be the first such.
I have followed the work of Paolo since 1957. I was anxious to see what this design would really be like. So I wrote him and said that I would phone him and that we could talk about it. Being an older lady, maybe I wouldn't be so suitable to the tasks at hand. He thought it might be an interesting experiment to see how an older person might survive. And we agreed that after 3 weeks, if I was too older, that I would find something else to do less invigorating. And happily, I was able to stay.
How does your experience here fit in with the scheme of your life?
We're at the time in life now that our family is gone that we should think about different patterns, and particularly search for different patterns and different ways of conducting our lives. I don't feel any private need to escape anything. I have enjoyed a very active life.
Nancy Gushman talks about a wine tasting party she organized.
That was a wonderful opportunity for me to share little saved up things so we could have a special day. So we had three different kinds of wine and three different kinds of cheese, and I think had a lovely warm exchange, really, on Sunday evening with some rice pilaf and a little curry sauce and some dancing and what I think I would call a lot of good warm vibrations.
Next, Tony Brown, site architect, discusses the development of the building process since the early days.
When you take it in sort of overall perspective from 4 years ago to what's here now, we've really come a long way. And to kind of illustrate that, what I did was I brought down some of the information that we had early on in the process, and also some information of what's happening at this point in time. This folder here is all the information from the start of Arcosanti up to the third year. This contains pretty much all the drawings, all the notes, the building of the cubes, the building of Plywood City.
3 years worth in one folder?
3 years worth. To give you sort of an idea of what's in here, I mean, I just thought I'd run through it fairly briefly. This is the field drawing for the plumbing in the vault. It's done on the back of the drawing, and this is a real vital drawing, this one. It's the only drawing that shows how the plumbing works in the storage areas under the vault. There's no copies of it. This is the original, and that's why we keep it real safe in this folder. I think you can get the sort of general idea of how things were done in the early days. The reason these were done like this wasn't just sort of out of sheer vindictiveness, but it was because there was only sort of two people running the whole operation, and the buildings were being done as the drawings were being drawn. Without drawings, it's a fairly wasteful, time-consuming process. What we generally do is we try and get base construction drawings together. In other words, the building itself, in terms of walls, floors, windows, and so on, without getting into the detail of how the finished cabinet work is going to be done or the windows or whatever. That allows us to start a little bit ahead of having a complete set of working drawings finished. We're in a little better position than a normal contractor-architect relationship because in a normal situation, you have to have a set of drawings that show absolutely everything so that anybody who's contracting for the job can sit down and can take off every nut and bolt in the building and then give you a price for it. We have a little leeway in as much as we can put in a lump sum budget figure for, say, finished work based on the square footage of the building, and if we go a little above or a little below, it's not so desperate as it is in the real world. We're talking in terms of developers' profits and so on. In 1972, I guess, was the first time we did a schedule. Our problem here is that our labour force fluctuates wildly at, from sort of 10 people up to 170. Also, our money situation fluctuates wildly. Sometimes we don't have money to do things because it tends to be a fairly hand-to-mouth process. And our machinery is not incredibly reliable, or some of it isn't. Our problem in terms of scheduling is we have so many variables, it becomes a much looser process. However, that didn't stop us from trying to schedule. So what we did the first year is 1972, that we did a schedule, and it's still hanging in the Octagon, I think, which it might give you some amusement to go and look at it. It was incredibly optimistic. So then what we did is that over 72, we got feedback which said, this is ridiculous.
Over the years, the schedule has become more accurate. About the schedule for 1975, Brown says,
we have a fairly optimistic schedule again, but it's optimistic in as much as we know it's optimistic, whereas the other years we thought we were right on the money. We have it's sort of two schedules in a way. The first schedule is an ideal schedule, assuming that we get enough money to do it. Now, within that schedule, we have a series of items that can be knocked out so that if we don't get the money, we can reduce our overall work without completely disrupting everything. For example, we have a figure in of $25,000 for kitchen equipment. Now, if we get that money, then we can install that equipment. If we don't, we can still build the building around it and try and put the equipment in next year. Up to this point, we haven't had any budgets at all. We just, for example, last year we just built until we ran out of money and nobody would bring us anything anymore. So we're going into a process which is called a ballooning budget, which is a system whereby you set your budget for 1 year. Whatever you don't get for that year, put that into the next year, which balloons that budget. So what we're trying to do for next year is we've set out a budget, which I think was $270,000 and something for materials, equipment and supplies. Now, that's a pretty huge increase. We've done an assumption on our budget next year in terms of it increasing the same rate as it did the first eight months of this year, and if that happens, we can get a certain percentage of that money, but we still need an additional $150,000 of income to do all the things that we'd like to do next year. That's the budget figure that we'd like someone to go out, and if somebody said, here's $150,000, we know where we could spend it, and we know we could spend it now to benefit of the project. The budget this year, in terms of materials and supplies and equipment again, was around $90,000. That's a very approximate guess. There's also another factor in that, in as much as the heavy equipment, the 50-ton crane, the batch plant, the backhoe, have all been bought by a guy called Skip Sager, who's the president of the furniture manufacturing company. And he's bought them, and he's allowing us to use them and pay him off at a very low rate, which happens to be $1,000 a month. If we'd had to buy that equipment ourselves, it would probably have taken up a whole operating budget for this year.
Next, we examine the educational aspect of the Arcosanti workshop.
Many people expect it to be more of an educational institution than it is. Our facilities have not allowed us at this time to put too much emphasis on the teaching.
So the intellectual life or the social life, it's utterly limited. It's almost non-existent.
An important part of the workshop experience is the weekly meeting Soleri has with all participants.
Let's say somebody has a basic understanding of what Soleri is about, or even if he's read, you know, he's plowed his way through Matter Becoming Spirit or Sitting in the Image of Man. But the point is, if you come here, for example, I read a lot of that stuff, and yet I came here expecting or hoping for a clarification and a real, you know, a real perspective on all of that.
That's what Soleri's meetings are for. He's not going to lecture you. You have to ask the questions. And that's what the whole thing is. If you come here with questions, he'll answer them to the best of his ability. And you can even ask him the same question every time, and he'll go into it.
every meeting. But that's what he comes here for.
Yeah,
but nobody's... You come here, this is not a classroom experience. They also said that in the brochure.
We are interested in augmenting the educational elements that we can offer here. And I think this will begin in 1975 and become much more obvious in 1976.
But still, the accent is on construction. And the learning process has to be found there, fundamentally.
I've been doing precasting and glazing and digging in the pit.
Did you have any experience, any construction experience before you came here?
Nope. It was pretty easy working in the pit. All I had to do was pick up a chisel and chisel rocks. Well, the glazing, I just followed Tim around for a while until I caught on to what he was doing. And the same thing with Charlie when I was doing precasting. I was interested in that, so I asked if I could work with him. That's what I really like doing the most.
Carpentry, mostly. Spent a long time building forms and then doing finished carpentry. That's just up on the hill, and then just do all kinds of projects of my own down camp.
Cosmic Ken?
Silk screening.
Silk screening. What kind of
work and
what kind of silk screening have you been doing?
Arcosani t-shirts.
This is what we've been working on for the whole 6 weeks. We've poured four 1,250-pound concrete planters, 7 feet 6 by 19 by 17. If we had a little more time, we'd plant them.
That's the chain hoist.
Our ton-and-a-half chain hoist that is used to roll over each of these flower pots because we cast them upside down.
Other tasks on the site, such as welding, plumbing, and operating and maintaining the heavy equipment, tends to be done by staff members. John Sandgren, a workshopper, comments on the work scene as a whole.
I think it's great. I have never seen anything like it before. People singing and whistling around the site is just phenomenal.
Perhaps an outstanding example of the will to work is when a semi-trailer load of cement in 90-pound bags arrives on the site. Everyone is marshaled to unload it into the cement shed.
Do you see this kind of thing very often?
No, sir, I sure don't.
What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's a pretty good crew, that's what I think. You sure got a lot of people here.
You do this around some other times?
No, this is the first time I've been in here.
Did they warn you?
No, they told me that I'd get unloaded pretty fast. They told me it would be by hand, though. Yeah, they said that they'd get a bunch of people up here and really start going.
12 minutes so far. You gotta wait till the last bag's in here.
Who's got the last bag?
I'll wait to be the last bag.
Okay. How does it feel?
Come on, get in the door. Is there a record pending or is there what sort of prize do I win for being the last bag? Why don't you bite the bag?
Come on, let's get out of here.
I think the people's will to work and to finish something that they have pride in is an advantage which you won't get in another construction site, which that's one reason I'm glad I came. I've learned so much in just doing it, much more than a book could ever tell me how to do.
How do you feel about Paolo's relationship to the construction work?
The fact that he's here quite a bit of the time, at least once a week, is a very good thing, only because at this point in the archaeology's growth, it's essential that he be here to sort of oversee what's happening. And unfortunately, many times even in the real world, as like everyone seems to call it, some architects never even see the buildings that their company has designed, and that isn't architecture to me.
So you feel that it's good that Paolo takes an interest in the smallest detail of the building.
He's a visionary at heart. And these times which he comes up to the site sort of give him some reality to the vision that he's sort of built in his mind. And to see it being put into concrete and steel is a nice thing. And that some maybe will mold some of his ideas as to the difficulty in building with this certain material and how it will work in the future in other archives.